All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Las Vegas.
It's more than just a city.
It's a feeling.
It's that feeling of excitement when you spot the lights of the Strip out the airplane window.
It's that feeling of awe as you stroll down the boulevard, taking in the sights and sounds.
And it's that feeling of satisfaction knowing that you're in the greatest city in the world.
Over 42 million people from around the world share that feeling every year.
And I'm one of them.
Taking you to the world-famous Vegas Strip and beyond, my name is Jeff. And this is Jeff Does Vegas. Welcome to From the Vault, a special series of episodes of Jeff Does Vegas. Over the 5 years I ran this podcast, from 2019 to 2024, I released over 180 episodes. And along the way, I talked to some very cool Vegas insiders, entertainers, and local experts. I also shared lots of tips and travel advice and explored the fascinating history of the city. I thought it might be fun to take a little trip back in time and reshare some of those episodes. So, whether you're a longtime follower looking for a re-listen, or you're a Vegas fanatic who just happened to stumble across the show, welcome. I hope you'll stick around for this conversation from the vault. My very special guest for this episode of the podcast has been working in the comedy business for nearly 35 years. He's been on stage around the world, and he's made literally hundreds of TV appearances throughout his career. Since 2005, he's been headlining his own show at the Luxor in Las Vegas, and he recently signed a contract extension that will keep him there through to 2030. His real name is Scott Thompson, but you know him best as Carrot Top. Scott and I talked about everything from his early days of prop comedy to how he comes up with his material to the current state of the comedy business to the apprehension he had when he initially signed on at the Luxor. Please enjoy my conversation with Carrot Top.
As a kid, I was always, you know, they've used the word class clown. I don't know if I was actually, you know, although I had the hair for it, but I wasn't like, you know, really interrupting class as much as I was entertaining the class after. You know, I mean, I never would get in trouble. The teachers never said, Scott, you know, once in a while I'd go in and tell jokes for, you know, after school. We'd be on the bus, and I'd, of course, they'd all come to me, what's the joke of the day? And I would tell, you know, the horrible jokes that my father would tell me, you know, the night prior when he came home from work. He would always have, my dad was a very good straight man, had great timing, and he always had the best old, like, classic jokes. And so I knew then, kind of, I mean, at a young age, that I loved making people laugh. Of course, I didn't think about being a professional comic. I just knew that I loved the idea of making people feel good and laugh. And my mom, if she was, she would probably say, "Oh no, you were destined to do this, because it was always would make her laugh or smile or something." And I remember I was like 13 probably, and I wrote my first joke, which I was on a beach with some friends, and we had built a big bonfire, and we were all just, you know, on a bonfire on the beach roasting marshmallows and whatever. And these cops came down and said, "You know, you can't have a fire on the beach." And I was like, "Why?" And he says, "It's dangerous." He says, we're next to two things that put fires out. We have water and sand. We can't be any safer of a place to put." And my friends were like, "That was." And the cop was like, "Trying to be funny?" I'm like, "No, I'm just being serious." Like, and the cop kind of looked at me like, "That's pretty smart. You're right. That you are in the safest place to have a bonfire. You know, take in the woods. You know, it's gonna." Yeah. So that was like literally how I started writing, like, or not writing, but kind of thinking observational kind of things. Which has always been my favorite. When I would go to see comics on TV or go to a show, it was always the moments where people would hit their guy next and said, "Oh my God, that happened to me today," like in traffic, or that happened to me in the restaurant. So the observational stuff was always kind of a fun thing.
Mm-hmm. And your family,
you didn't have a showbiz family.
No, further from it. My father was a scientist at NASA and trained astronauts, and my mom was she owned a tennis shop, and she was a very, very kind of outgoing social lady, still is. But no, I was not. And my brother went to the Air Force Academy and became an F-16 fighter jet pilot. So yeah, where did Caretop, where did this happen? How did this happen? I think that's part of maybe the funny part of it. Maybe that's why it happened, because I wasn't even, you know, I wasn't Liza Minnelli's son. I was, you know, I was the son of a rocket scientist. So how did I find my way into this world?
Who did you laugh at early on? Who were your comedy idols?
I still have books over here. I mean, George Carlin, Robin Williams, but even the Marx Brothers, Jonathan Winters. You know, there were so many comics. I remember, you know, I think I bought, like, unfortunately, you know, to say Bill Cosby, but you know that I memorized that entire album. I mean, from head to toe. So yeah, there was a lot, and what's fun too, I think, which is weird because my style of comedy is so different than anybody else's, and people always say, well, like, who did you pick to choose to, like, emulate or copy? And I used to say I kind of tried to copy a little bit of everybody. Like, I couldn't be George Carlin, you know, he was there was no one going to be George Carlin. So I thought, and you know, I liked my props and I liked the variety, but I wanted it to be a smart kind of props. So I kind of, in a sense, was kind of like George Carlin, observational, yet made it into a visual format. But if you break it down, it wouldn't be a pun. So we could break it down. Any prop that I have is usually something you could actually put in print, and you'd get a laugh by saying, said it's like shoehorn, shoeing a horn. It's not funny. I never liked the pun aspect of props. Which is how they always, when they think of me and they ask me to do show, they always say, so this is the joke, Family Guy, which is up there on the wall there. They called me and they said, we have this, you want to be in Family Guy? And I said, absolutely. And they said, here's the joke. And it was like a seesaw. And it was a saw with glasses on it. And I hated it so bad. I said, you know, and it felt weird because I'm in the actual, like, the people that put this together. There's like 30 writers, and Seth MacFarlane is looking at me like, right? It's great, right? And I said, can I be brutally honest? And he goes, yeah. I said, I hate it. And I really don't like it. And he goes, why? And I said, it's the play on words. It's really not. Can I pick up one of my jokes and do it that way? And he says, well, we could, but we already have the animation done. So they kind of screw you. So I'm like, oh, you already have it? Yeah, so we already spent $1 billion on animation. So you want to do it or not do it? I said, I'll do it. So I read the line. Hey, it's a seesaw. So, but people still to this day walk up and say, seesaw. It's the weirdest thing.
What prompted that move to prop comedy?
You know, I don't know. I'll tell you, I was trying to do comedy, and I went to, I did stand, you know, normal, monology, whatever, talk about, parking at the, because that's where I started at college, and I talk about the college and the parking and books and, the cafeteria and things that were relatable to my audience. And I did pretty good. And then I went to a comedy club and I did the same act. And the lady was, I still remember, Colleen McGarr. And she said, there's something about you. You have it. You have the it. But you, your material is very, very specific to one thing. I said, well, that's what I'm performing to, a bunch of drunk college kids. And she's like, well, if you want to play the comedy club, and you're going to have to come up with a little more of a broad kind of material. And so I said, oh, okay, well, now it's harder. So I really didn't know what to do. I was like, I don't even know what that means. So I went back to my dorm, and I was trying to write jokes that weren't specifically related to college. And I had a couple that would work anywhere. No, you can smoke weed, but you can't have a hot plate. Like, what's going on there? No, you smoking weed? No, just making soup. Get out of here. And it was always, that would work, because people, even if you were in college or didn't. And I think I came up with there was a Crime Watch sign that was on my wall in my dorm, and my roommate, one day when I came home, he said, where'd you get that? And I said, I stole it. And everyone laughed. Everyone that came to my dorm would laugh. That's funny. I said, I stole it. So my friend, I think, said, that'd be a good joke. You should go on stage and say, look, sorry I'm late. I was in the neighborhood. How good is our Crime Watch if then I'm watching the signs? And that was my first legitimate joke that I wrote myself, and it was a visual. And then the woman, when I went down and tried to audition for the show, the club, she said, "That, do you have more of that?" And I'm like, what do you mean? Like more stolen stuff? She goes, yeah. Like I can go steal more signs. And she said, well, whatever it takes. But I like the visuals. That visual was great. And it was very clever and it's smart. So I went and I started stealing signs. And I took like, I think I had like a dozen like signs around Boca Raton that I went and my buddies and we stole them. And there was a whole bunch of, you know, like no train horn between certain hours. And I'd say, that's when you need the horn. You can't see the train. And it was very clever. And, there was a slow figure, you know, it said little children at play, and they still make these signs where there's no feet. And I said, well, no wonder they're slow, they don't have feet. So it was all these really good signs. And then I had, so that's why it was my first little prop, like, you know, it would do about 2 minutes, and that's all you needed to get in the show. And I think I won a couple of contests, and then the woman said, if you could maybe think that way with the visual stuff, I really think that's kind of like your style. You know, Gallagher. I said, yeah, I know who Gallagher is, but I didn't want to be him. So then I started writing, literally, I went on a rampage. I wrote like, you know, a cowboy boot with a kickstand so rednecks wouldn't fall down. I mean, I was on a roll, and the more props I made, the longer I could do. And so I said, you know, I can be a feature now because I built like 30 props. So it just kind of turned into that format of kind of being a prop guy. And then, you know, there it is, TV shows, and it was all that kind of, which is kind of fun now because when I go to the live show now, I get to do more stand-up than I do on the back then because when I did the Tonight Show at Regis, they wouldn't allow me, but they were like, we really don't want to hear you talk. We want to see your props. That's what Carrot Top is, props. We don't want to see you talk like Seinfeld. And, you know, so I said, okay, so now I have the luxury now where my live show, I can do, you know, a little bit of whatever, a little variety, which has been fun to kind of grow as a stand-up, as more of just a prop guy.
Where do you pull inspiration from when you're coming up with props? Is it current events? Is it just like, oh, look at that, I can make something out of that?
Absolutely.
Is it all of it?
Yep, all of that, yeah. There's the observational things, there's the current events, absolutely. There's, you know, gas prices going up, so I have a gas, you know, prop with a, you know, it's an actual gas pump handle that has a rear view mirror on it, so you can see yourself getting fucked while you're pumping it. So look at that, Dad's getting fucked. So it's and that one kills. I mean, and then we added music to it. Give it to me, baby. You know, so kind of just take a layer, and then I beat a joke to death. Yeah, but yeah, so it's all that. Yeah, it could be something just I see today, or I could see something. I was on an airplane yesterday. I was thinking a lot of the jokes in the show are from just everyday, you know, seeing things that, like, there's something funny about that. Like, the wearing the mask at the airport, I do a bit about that where the guy says, you got to take your mask down. And I go through TSA and I take it down. And he looks at my ID, and he's like, you're good to go. So I took a picture. Here's me before I took my mask down. It's me with a mask on with all my hair. And then this, thank God I pulled it down. It's just the same. It's just that, you know, so it gets a big laugh because people, they not only have been through it, but they see the absurdity in it. Like, you know, well, thank God he checked to see if it was me. Like, fuck.
Yeah. In putting together props and jokes, has there ever been a time when you've been like, ooh, too far?
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, I think every comic, I usually don't go at the, I never take it. I mean, there's been some I've done in the, you know, everyone has to have one or two. They were like kind of risky. But I think most, I wouldn't say all, most comics, I think they need to, they know the boundaries of what something that might be considered, not even the word inappropriate, just really just too soon kind of thing. So anything that has to do with, you know, death, you know, plane crashes, things that are just horrible, definitely not. I mean, there's no place for it. Now, the one that I did get away with was it's funny, the shelf life of jokes when the plane landed in the Hudson. Uh-huh. And no one died, you know, boom, you can tell a joke because no one died. And that was the whole thing. Hey, no one died. And we have at the Luxor, there's a bodies exhibit and a Titanic museum. I said, you know, just think, if one person had died, we'd have the fucking exhibit right here at the Luxor. And that would just slay, you know, because no one did die. But yeah, just think, if one person, we would have an exhibit. Hey, go see the Titanic, and now go see the Hudson crash, whatever. Death on the Hudson. So, I don't have people that tell me what I can do and can't do. I just kind of make the judgment in my own head what I think might be, you know. And now, you know, as long, I've been doing this so long now, you know, seeing the roller coaster of what is inappropriate, what people consider to be inappropriate, you know, it's amazing. I've seen it go. I mean, I've been through the whole, you know, 30 some years of seeing how audiences kind of react and think and look around more than they probably would have back then. I mean, there's always been, you know, that. There's always been that, but you know, we're getting a little better. I think people are trying to start to say, you know, we can't be too sensitive, especially if you're at a comedy show. It's kind of our job to be a little, push it a little bit.
I'm assuming you have got a massive warehouse of props and
we
things
do.
That you kind of have in the
across
archive.
The street. Yeah, it's great. And I love walking through there because you see years and years of things that, like, oh, remember that used to do? Oh my God, that used to be such a great. And sometimes it's fun to reinvent them if it's possible. Mm-hmm. Or a part, you know, like the gas pump handle. I used to be a different joke with that one. So I said, where's that damn gas pump? Because I don't want to have to go steal another one. So, yeah.
How often do you pull stuff out of the archive and throw it in the show?
It depends on, yeah, sometimes a lot of times. I mean, yeah, I'm always changing something. I like to add something from the archives once in a while to keep it fresh for me. And then a lot of times the audience hadn't seen it too. I have a lot of new fans, and I'll present it in the way that, hey, check this out. This is stuff from my the Carrot Classics that goes back to, you know, when I started, and that's kind of fun. People that had seen it will, you know, reminisce and remember it, and people that haven't will be like, oh, that's cool. You can see that it's how some of it's dated, which makes it cool. So it shows that you have, like, stuff that you can tell was, you know, like a bank tube or something joke where they could tell that was old.
The Quarter Pounder with Cheese had many great things. Maple-flavored griddle cakes isn't one of them. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
I want to talk a little bit about the business of comedy today.
Yeah.
Who do you find funny right now? What are some of your favorite comedians?
Nobody. No, I like, you know, it's funny. I've just answered this question the day with just a friend. They were like, who's the new up and coming young comics you like? And I said, you know, the bad side about doing a show overnight here in Vegas is it's not that I can't not do it, but I don't have the luxury to try to explore and look for new comics that are out there, maybe even be a mentor to one. I do my show and then I go home and then it's late and then I go, I don't want to watch comedy. And when I lived in LA, I would go to the clubs a lot because I would sit in the back and watch all, you know, there could be 30 comics in a night and sit there and just laugh and go, wow, that guy's going to be, I mean, I've seen so many that I said, that guy's going to be huge. And they ended up being huge. I mean, remember Larry the Cable Guy was a buddy of mine. I said, this guy is going to be huge. And, you know, boom, I knew he had that, you know, that shtick too. He'd just read the phone book and would make you laugh.
Yeah. Do you think present day now with social media being what it is, YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, that kind of stuff, do you think it's easier for people to break into comedy and get discovered, or is it a situation where it's just such a diluted
That is a great question. People. I wish that was a question I could answer with no one. Because I say that all the time. I say, you know, I don't know if I started again right now today, would I have the you know, the energy I just remember what a long journey it was getting into this. However, like you just said, with all the other ways like TikTok and all that, there might be more ways to get involved and people see your stuff without waiting at a comedy club until 2 a.m. to perform in front of 10 people. So, you know, there is an advantage probably to that. You know, TikTok crowd, they're funny and a million people see it in one day where, you know, it took me, you know, it would take you, you know, 5 years to get a million people to see your stuff. So yeah. there's a good point there. I don't know if that, the answer if that, but I know a lot of very successful people that have come through the social media aspect of it. Which is funny because I'm trying to do that too, just to keep up with the young people, you know, do the TikToks and do all those things and show people, hey, I'm still here.
Um, Talking about Las Vegas, I mean, the residency here at the Luxor, this is 16 years now that you've 16. Been here and just signed back on for another.
I think it's either four or something. I forget. I think we signed to 5 years. So I don't know if the 1 year counts with COVID, but yeah.
Yeah. At this point, does it even matter how many more years you've signed?
Well, yeah, you kind of want to know. Because, I mean, you want to know. Yeah, I don't know how many have left, so you can kind of plan. But I hope I stay here. I hope I stay here for you know, till the end. But yeah, I mean, it's been 16 at this hotel and then 10 at the MGM and one at Bally's. So it's been a crazy run.
When you sign a big residency like that, I remember doing an interview one time with Meatloaf, and I asked him about doing a residency, a Vegas residency. And he had said at the time he was friends with Bette Midler and she was doing one here. And he said, oh, hell no, I have no desire to do something like that. I see what she goes through and how much work it is and blah, blah, blah. When you first got that offer to come to the Luxor for a long term like that, was there that apprehension and that concern, like, oh my God, am I going to be able to actually pull this off?
Yes, Meatloaf actually told me that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, I was very, very much apprehensive about it. In fact, I've said it before, and when I was at the MGM and I was doing kind of an intermittent residency, it wasn't like a full-on residency like what we have here. It would be like a week, and I'd go on the road, I'd go to, you know, Calgary, go to, and then come back to Vegas and do 2 weeks and then go back on the road and come back to Vegas. I did like, I think it was 8 to 10 weeks a year, sometimes 12, but not, you know, what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. And then when David Copfield wanted to have that room full time, which I used to make a joke, David Copfield, how come you left the MGM Grand? I said, because David Copfield made me disappear. And then I went to the newspaper with that, and he called me, like, literally said, what the hell? I said, it's a joke. You didn't really literally make me disappear. David, you're a magician. And so the Luxor, I remember there was this room was available, or it could be. And my people said to me, what do you think about it? And I said, you know, 12 weeks a year, yeah, I'll do that. He said, no, full time. And I said, oh, Jesus, it's like a desk job. I don't know if I could do that every night. So
yeah.
We came over, looked at the room. I liked the room. And then I remember thinking, oh my God, can I do like a month and maybe just do and see if I like it? I can't sign off. So I think we signed on a year, and I was miserable because I had to stay in the hotel, which is not a bad thing. They have a beautiful hotel, but you know, going into go to your room and back, the only way to go up and the access to your room back was through the elevator, inclinator, sideways.
Yeah.
And you know, you never, I'm just going to go get a cup of coffee or go get lunch or go do this. You have to go down the elevator to the people, to the crowd, to the, you know, to the casino. And it was just a nightmare. So I bit off more than I can chew. I'm not digging this at all. And then I finally found a house, and then I got into a nice little rhythm. Mm-hmm. But it still took the first, I think it was 3 years we had. It took a long time to get used to doing the show every night in the same city, in the same theater. And Vegas is a different, all different beast. I mean, we go on the road, we do road shows. You know, more than half the crowd's got Carrot Top shirts on. They've, you know, they prepared and planned for a night out to see Carrot Top. Vegas, sometimes they're like, oh, we can't get into Blue Man Group. We'll go see this Carrot Top guy. It's either blue or orange. And but you might win them over. Mm-hmm. You know, they come and I used to do that, but I'm afraid to ask now. How many people first time seeing my show? And I was, ugh. But you win them over, and then you're like, okay, I just got into a rhythm. One day I just got into a rhythm, and I was like, I love this gig. And then I realized, man, I really don't want to leave, and I want to stay mm-hmm. a Vegas guy. And both. I'm just a Vegas guy. People always say, oh, you're just a Vegas guy.
What do you think has contributed to that longevity? I mean, 16 years in one place is huge. It puts you in some pretty elite company in this city. There's not too many people that have done residencies that long. I mean, what do you think is contributing to that?
I really honestly don't know the answer to that as well. It's a mystery because I always think the same thing. I can't believe I'm still here and they're still coming. And I can only think that maybe I keep the show fresh. I mean, I do get a lot of people that say, hey, man, I saw your show. And it's always new. It's always, even if there's some things that aren't, there's always going to be a new aspect or a new look or a new sound effect or new staging, new and something just to make the show a little new. And the material, you know, up to date, you can tell them, you know, I'm talking about current, you know, things. So I don't know. But again, if I knew the answer to that, I probably, yeah. But I do notice it. I mean, I realize it. It's not a night goes by. I'm like, I'm lucky people are here and they're digging it and having fun.
You've had a lot of celebs come out to the show as well, yeah. Which is really cool. Are you ever surprised by who your fans are? Like somebody shows up and you're like, oh, never in a million years.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's kind of a cool, that's kind of the thing. I don't know. I've been in this, what do they call the show business for so many years that I still get starstruck like from people. I feel like, no, but you know that you meet presidents and you meet this, but like, you know, it's weird. Is you always get a little excited. Like Shania Twain is coming to the show, you know, they walk in the door and they're like, hi. And it's just, and then we realize they're just normal people, but it's just still that little sparkle factor of like, oh my God, I grew up with, you know, her, or you know, yeah, we've had everybody here. Mm-hmm. Queen was probably the biggest. Queen, the band.
Yeah.
That was pretty amazing. I mean, that was kind of pinched me. Everyone was just kind of looking at each other like, fucking Queen is there in my dressing room. Like, how did this happen?
Yeah.
What bet did they have to lose to go see Carrot Top? And they came two nights in a row to the show.
Wow.
Yeah. And they came back, had drinks, talked shop. I mean, literally, it was right before the movie came out, and they were very... They're very upfront about how they didn't know if they thought it was going to be a good movie. They thought it was going to bomb. Isn't that weird? And it became, I think, one of the biggest movies that ever came out. But, you know, getting their info prior to before it came out, they were like, yeah, we don't know. It's, you know, Scott, we didn't know. So, and then I came out, I'm like, holy moly. I mean, $1 billion yeah. over everywhere.
Is that, I mean, you're a music guy. I know from having seen your show. I mean, you love all kinds of music and classic rock particularly. Yes. You have a big part of that. When guys like Queen come backstage and want to talk shop with you, how surreal is that for you?
Oh, it is. And what they want to talk about is, well, one, they'll say, they got so much music in your show, so you must be somehow, you know, you must love music. And they see the guitars, and I said, actually, I play drums. And then, you know, of course, Roger Taylor's like, drums, will you go misplay? I said, no. I don't play drums. I mean, I can play drums, but I'm not a drummer. Let's put it that way. I mean, I can keep a beat. You're a drummer.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, and then they want to talk shop. They want to talk about what I do. That's what makes it fun. You know, I'm asking them, like, what's it like when you're doing, like, you know, We Will Rock You, or how you wrote that? And he's like, well, I want to know how you wrote the gas pump handle with the mirror on it. Like, they really are. They're like, how do you come up with that?
Yeah.
So, and I'm like, how do you come up with the song? So, yeah, it's a mutual admiration for one another's kind of, you know, work. And they were really, really sweet. And like I said, they came two nights in a row, and they loved it. They were fun.
It is really weird when that happens. I had an experience like that with Alice Cooper.
Oh, he's a nice guy.
Super nice guy. And I interviewed him, and we did a whole half hour or whatever talking about music. And he was hosting the Alice Cooper radio show at that point. And so after we were done, he came around the other side of the board and started asking me questions about radio and about this. And
that's cool.
In my brain, I'm like, holy shit, it's Alice Cooper. He's asking me questions about yeah. radio. This is so odd.
Cool. Yeah, that's cool.
You've been in Vegas for a long time. What are some of the biggest changes that you've seen?
Oh, definitely the growth. I mean, when I first had a show here, there wasn't the MGM Grand, I think, was just built. So I remember we went to it. It was like, so big, we're like, holy, that was like the deal, right? You're just like walk around the MGM Grand. It was so big. So the number one, the growth, I mean, the number of hotels, and that is a joke in my show. Your room's not ready. So are you cleaning it? No, we're building it right now. You can pick out the carpet. But yeah, the growth, and of course, the kind of actually, I think, because the number of acts and shows in this town too. You know, when I was doing at the MGM or Bally's, it was like, a dozen shows or, you know, whatnot. There's one at Caesars, one there. There wasn't, I think there's like, I don't even know the number of shows that's open in one night on a given night in Vegas. Uh-huh. But there's thousands, you know. So that's one, you know, that's one thing I think I've seen. And the people that come to Vegas, the shows. I mean, I remember right when I first got the show and they were like, you know, MGM or Vegas was kind of like, that's where you go to die kind of thing. You know, you got a show in Vegas, you know, road guys are stars, Vegas guys are, you know. And then now you're looking and, you know, everyone in the world is here. From Elton John to Rod Stewart to Adele to, you know, the list goes on and on. The biggest of the biggest names want to have a show in Vegas. So that's been an interesting thing to see change. And I'm like, hey, I always thought it was cool. What about, you know? But, yeah, that's, you know, any given night you can see, like, you know, George Strait, or you can go see, you know, in the same night.
Yeah.
George Strait or you know, Metallica and the Stones and Carrot Top, all in the same night in Vegas.
I appreciate this, again. I really do. This is huge for me. I'm a big fan of you and of your work. And so having the opportunity to sit down and chat with you has been fantastic. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for letting me come on, and thanks for coming to Vegas. And hello, Canada.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.